Sounds like, sure, but it's hard to hear as Graham fires up his cruiser again in the background. The flare of taillights paints Javier's face crimson. He looks tired, and he rubs his face like a man trying to scrub away the last few hours. I wonder if this will drive him away from being my friend, as surely as it has Sam Cade, as surely as it will Officer Graham, once he knows my past. Not that he's truly a friend, just friendly. Nobody stays. I should know that by now. Nobody but the kids, who don't have a choice in the matter because they're mired in this bog just as I am, up to the neck. Lady, what the hell are you into? Javier asks me. But I don't think he wants to know. Not really.
Look, I told you. I'm a reserve deputy.
I like you, but if it comes down to it, you'll do your duty, just like you did tonight, I nod. I get it. I'm just surprised you agreed to help me leave town in the first place. I thought you were running from an abusive ex. I've seen the look plenty of times. I didn't know. Didn't know what? I challenge him directly this time, staring right into his eyes. I can't read him, but I don't think he can read me either. Not completely. That you're involved in something like this, he says. I'm not involved. Doesn't look like that. Javi, let's keep this real, Miss Proctor. You get cleared, we're cool. But until you are, let's keep some distance, okay? And if you want my advice, you get the guns out of your house and turn them over to the range for safekeeping. We can hold them for you until this blows over, and I can swear out an affidavit for the PD. I just hate to think... You hate to think about the cops coming and me having a small arsenal in here, I say softly, about the collateral damage that could cause. He nods slowly. There's nothing aggressive about his body language, but there's strength underlying it, a kind of calm, masculine strength that makes me want to believe in him, trust him. I don't. I'll hang on to my weapons until I see a court order telling me to surrender them, I tell him. I don't blink. If he thinks it's aggressive, so be it. In this moment, in all moments now, I can't afford to be seen as weak. Not for myself. I have two children in the house, and I'm responsible for their lives, lives that are never safe, never secure. I will do anything I must to defend them, and I'm not giving up my weapons. Javier shrugs. The gesture says he doesn't care. The regretful slowness of it says he does. He doesn't say goodbye, just turns and walks to the white van he's driven up in, the one I came so, so close to escaping in. Before I can speak, he rolls down the window and pitches me the title for the Jeep. He doesn't say the trade is off, but then he hardly has to. I watch him drive the big cargo van away, title in my hand, and then I turn and go back into the house. It's dark and quiet, and I silently double-check everything as I reset the alarm. The kids are used to the tones, and I don't think it will wake them. But as I walk down to check on Connor, Lanny opens her door. We stare at each other in silence for a moment in the gloom, and then she gestures me in and shuts the door behind me. My daughter curls up on her bed, knees up, arms circling them. I recognize the posture, though she might not. I remember finding her many times like this in the months after my release from jail, after my trial. It's defensive, though she makes it look natural enough. So, she says, they didn't throw you back in. I didn't do anything, Lanny. You didn't last time either, she points out, which is flawlessly true. I hate this. Connor's scared to death, you know. I know, I say. I ease down on the bed and she scoots her toes back so she isn't touching me. It breaks my heart a little, but I'm eased a bit when she doesn't flinch as I put my hand on her knee. Sweetheart, I won't lie to you. Your father knows where we are. I was planning to get us out of here, but... But now there's this dead girl and the police know who we are and we can't go, she says. Smart child. She doesn't blink, but I see something glimmering like tears. I should never have said anything about it. If I hadn't... Honey, no. You did the right thing, all right? Never think that. If I hadn't said anything, we'd be gone by now, she continues doggedly, right over me. We'd be homeless again, but at least we'd be safe and he wouldn't know where we are. Mom, if he knows...
She stops talking, and the tears glisten harder, fatter, and break free to run down her cheeks. She doesn't wipe them away. I'm not even sure she's aware it's happening.
He'll hurt you, she says in a faint whisper,
and she tilts her head forward to rest her forehead against her knees. I move up next to her and hold her, my child, and she is a hard knot of muscle and bone and grief. She doesn't relax against me. I tell her it'll be all right, but I know she doesn't believe me. I finally leave her there, silent, closed into her protective ball, and go to check her brother. He seems asleep, but I don't think he is. He looks pale and there are dark, delicate lilac smudges under his eyes, like the aftermath of bruises. He's so tired. So am I. I close the door quietly, go to my own room, and fall into a vast, dreamless sleep with the silence of Stillhouse Lake pressed drowning deep around me. In the morning, there's another girl floating dead in the lake. 8. I'm woken by a scream. I come bolt upright in bed, scrambling out even before I'm aware of being awake, stepping with the efficiency of a firefighter into my jeans and pulling a t-shirt on as I step into shoes heading to the door. I realize as I come out of my bedroom that it isn't either of my kids screaming. Their doors are flying back, too. Lanny looking bleary in her flannel robe, Connor still bare-chested in pajama pants with his hair sticking up on one side. Stay here, I shout at them, racing to the front room. I sweep the curtains back and stare out at the lake. The screaming is coming from a small rowboat drifting about 20 feet from the dock. There are two people inside it, an older man wearing a fisherman's hat and utility vest, and a woman older than me with ash-blonde hair who's recoiled against him. He's holding her, and the boat's violently rocking, as if she's thrown herself backward so suddenly she almost swamped it. I turn off the alarm and run outside, feet pounding on the gravel and then the wood of the dock, and I slow down when I see the body. It's come up from the darkness. This one is naked, floating on her stomach, and I can see long hair drifting like seaweed on the surface of the water. The raw chicken color of exposed muscles looks nauseating in the dim morning light, but it's unmistakable. Someone has taken off most of the skin from her buttocks and the small of her back, and a broad stripe up to expose the alien white growth of her spine. But not all her skin. Not this time. The woman suddenly stops screaming and lunges to lean over the side of the craft to vomit. The man hasn't made a sound, and his move to steady the boat is automatic, the reaction of a man who's been on the water most of his life, but isn't really here. Shock. His expression's blank, and he stares straight ahead, trying to process what he's seeing. I take out my cell phone and dial 911. There isn't any choice. This is at my door. As I listen to the rings, I think about the inescapable, horrific fact that the body has been down there under the surface, waiting, slowly rising like a lazy, ghostly bubble, until it finally breaks the water's smooth hold. It floated there last night while I talked to Javier. It floated there while I slept. It might have been lurking farther below the surface on the night I sat on the porch with Sam Cade and drank beer and talked about Melvin Royal. The woman in the boat throws up again, weeping. I finally get an answer on the emergency line. I don't think about what I'm saying, but I describe the scene, the location, give my name. I know I sound too calm, and that will hurt me later when people review the recording. They ask me to stay on the line, but I don't. I hang up and pocket my cell instead, as I try to think. One dead, horribly mutilated woman could have been an awful coincidence. Two have to be a plan. The police will be here soon, and when they come, I'll be taken in. This time, the questions will come in earnest. I'm going to be arrested. I'm going to lose my kids. A text alert sounds, and I take out my phone to see it's from Absalom's anonymous number. I swipe to read it. It's just a link. I click it and watch as the screen fills with the blocky design of a message board.
I don't take note of which one. I just blow up the text to read the initial post. It's about me. Found. One murdering bitch. Yeah, boy, I tracked down Melvin's little helper. Pictures and everything. Solid intel. His spawn are with her, so she didn't drown the little bastards yet. Even better, there's a murder. Deets later. There's a flood of replies, hundreds of them, but the original poster is teasing the info, giving non-answers, hints, denying rumors. And then, about 5 swipes of my finger down the scroll, he drops one deadly piece of solid fact. Bitch is hiding out in the volunteer state. That must have sent at least half the readers scrambling for Google, but I know it instantly. He knows I'm in Tennessee. That means he almost certainly knows I'm at Stillhouse Lake. He likely has the same pictures that Melvin has seen, or he's the original source of them. My chess move didn't work with my murdering ex-husband. He's dropped the hammer, and right now I imagine him lying on his bunk, laughing, imagining my safety being stripped away like strips of skin, masturbating at the thought of it. The agony of it is breathless. I feel weightless for a moment, not quite falling, not quite stable. It's out. We're out. All my work, all my running, all the hiding. It's done. The internet is forever. Trolls never forget. I hear sirens in the distance. The police are on their way. The dead girl floats in steady dips and bobs, hair twisting and swirling like slow smoke. The rowboat is now moving away, making for the dock. The fisherman must have finally snapped out of his trance. When I look up, I see his face has gone a sickly, pre-heart attack color, and he's rowing with furious strength. His wife is slumped against him, looking nearly as bad. These are people whose safe, normal world has broken underneath their feet, and they've fallen into a darker place, the place where I live. I can see the police car lights cresting a distant hill, heading out from Norton. I text Absalom. Doesn't matter now. I'm about to be arrested. There's an endless space before his reply comes with a sharp, vibrating buzz to announce it, like an angry wasp before the sting. Fuck. Did you do it? He has to ask. Everyone has to ask. I text back, no, and turn off the phone again. As the rowboat bumps hard against the dock, almost a crash, I toss a line to the fisherman. It hits his wife, which I didn't intend, but she doesn't seem to even notice. I sense someone else watching now, and I turn my head. Sam Cade is standing on his porch about 2 football fields away. He's wearing a red and black checked bathrobe and slippers, and he's staring at me, at the traumatized boaters. I sense his attention move to the body in the lake, then back to me. I don't look away. Neither does he. He turns and walks back into his cabin. I help the older woman out of the boat, then her husband, and sit them down on a bench nearby as I run back to the house for warm blankets. I'm pulling those around their shoulders as the first police cruiser scrapes to a halt a few feet away, lights strobing urgently but sirens silent now. Behind it comes the boxy sedan, and I'm not surprised to see Detective Prester behind the wheel. He looks like he hasn't slept at all. I feel dead, numb. I straighten up as he exits the vehicle. 2 other younger uniformed officers get out of the cruiser. Neither one is Officer Graham, but I recognize them from around the Norton beats. There are more on the way, a whole stream of cars heading toward us now. There's a feeling of inevitability about this dawn. I know I should be afraid, but I'm not. Somehow all that fear has gone away after seeing this poor woman in the lake, abandoned and destroyed, as if this has been coming all along, and on some level, I've known it. I see Prester approach, and I turn to him to say, "Please make sure my kids are all right. Someone's leaked our location to the internet. They've had death threats. Real ones. I don't care what happens to me right now, but they have to be safe." His face is set and hard, but he nods quietly. He pauses next to me and looks at the 2 unfortunates who were in the boat. I turn away as he questions them. I look at Sam Cade's cabin, and before too long, I am rewarded. I see him come out again, dressed in faded jeans and a plain gray T-shirt. He locks his door, both locks, I notice, and slowly descends the steps to walk toward us. The patrol officers haven't managed to set up a cordon yet, and there's not really a need. Sam walks straight across and stops just a few feet from me. We don't speak for a moment, and he puts his hands in his jeans pockets and rocks back and forth, staring not at me but at the bobbing body in the lake. "Want me to call anybody?" he asks it of the empty air, as if he's asking the dead girl. I'm not really looking at him, either. It's a conversation in which neither of us is willing to commit, so typical of both of us. "I think that's a little late," I say. And I mean that for the dead girl and me, both. We're both lost and adrift now, exposed to the world without any hope of shelter. I'm instantly ashamed of myself for thinking of us as being in any way alike, though. I didn't spend hours, maybe days, suffering at the hands of a sadist, and then experience the horror of dying at his hands. I'd only been married to one. I told Prester, but if you could just make sure he looks after Connor and Lanny. The word's gotten out, Sam, about where we are. Did you do that? He snaps his attention to me with a suddenness that feels completely natural. I can see the pulse of surprise, the shift in the way he feels. Did I what? Did you dox me out on the internet? Of course I didn't, he blurts with a frown, and I believe him. I wouldn't do that, Gwen, no matter what. I wouldn't put you or the kids at risk like that. I nod. I don't really think it was him, though he'd be a logical suspect. No, I imagine some bright bulb in the Norton Police Department decided to get some righteous anonymous justice on. Could even be a clerk. Anyone in the chain of discovery with knowledge of my old identity, ending with Detective Prester. I can't even really blame them. Nobody's forgotten Melvin Royal. Nobody's forgotten Melvin's little helper, either. There's a certain rabid, unhealthy fascination people have with male serial killers, but female accomplices are hated so much more. It's a toxic stew of misogyny and self-righteous fury, and the simple, delicious fact that it's okay to destroy this woman, where it's not okay to destroy others. I can never be forgiven for being innocent, because I'll never be innocent. Sam looks away again, and I think, somewhat irrationally, that he wants to tell me something, confess something. He rocks back and forth some more, says nothing, and then he shakes his head and starts to walk away toward my house. Detective Prester says, without turning or shifting his attention, "Mr. Cade, I'll be needing a word with you, too." "You can find me at Miss Proctor's house," he says. "I'm going to make sure the kids are okay." I can see Prester debating whether or not to push it, but he clearly decides it can wait. He's got his big fish on the line. No point in catching more than he can fillet at one time. I text Lanny quickly that it's okay to let Sam in, and when he gets to the door, she throws it open and flings herself into his hug. So does Connor. It's surprising how easily they welcome him, and I admit I feel a little stab of hurt. For the first time, I wonder if me continuing to be part of their lives is actively, constantly damaging them. And the question is so big, so awful, that it makes my breath catch and swell painfully in my throat. That question might be out of my hands now. My kids might be swept away into the social services system, and I might never see them again. Stop. You're thinking like he wants you to think. Like a helpless victim. Don't let him take away what you've achieved. Fight for it. I let my eyes drift close and will myself to let go of the worry, the pain. My breath eases, and when I open my eyes, I find Detective Prester has finished with the two boaters who found the body. He's coming my way. I don't wait. I turn and head for his sedan. I hear the slight scuffle of his shoes on the deck as he's caught off guard, but he doesn't tell me that I'm wrong. I know that he wants to question me in private. We get into the back seat, me on the passenger side, him behind the driver's spot, and I sink into the warm, cheap upholstery with a slow sigh. I'm tired, suddenly. Still scared, on some deep animal level, but I know that whatever's happening now I can't change. "You said the information about you is on the internet," Prester says. Before we get started, I want you to know that's not my doing. If it was anybody in our shop, I'll find out and tear them a new asshole.
Thanks, I say. But that doesn't help now, does it?
He knows it doesn't and hesitates only a second before he pulls a digital recorder from his pocket and turns it on. Detective Prester, Norton Police Department. Today's date is... He checks his watch, which I find funny, until I see he's wearing a vintage one with a calendar built right in. September 23rd. The time is 7:32. I'm interviewing Gwen Proctor, also known as Gina Royal. Ms. Proctor, I'm going to read you your rights. It's just a formality. It isn't, of course, and I quirk a smile at that. I listen as he lists them with the droning ease of a man who has a lot of practice at Mirandizing, and when he finishes, I tell him that I understand the rights he has explained. We're both pleasant, getting the basics out of the way. Two old hands at this. Prester's voice changes to a low, quiet rumble. Would you prefer I call you Gwen?
That's my name.
Gwen, this morning a second body was found floating in the lake within sight of your front door. You have to understand this looks bad given your, well, your history. Your husband is Melvin Royal, and he has a very specific kind of past. The first girl we found in the lake, that might have been a strange coincidence, I'll allow that. But two of them? Two are a plan.
Not my plan, I say. Detective, you can ask me a million questions a million ways, but I'm going to tell you everything I know straight up. I heard the scream. It woke me right out of bed. I came out of my room the same time as my kids. They can vouch for that. I came out here to find out what was going on, and I saw the two people in the boat and the body in the water. That is absolutely everything I know about this situation. I know even less about that first body.
Gwen. There's so much reproach in Prester's voice that he sounds like a disappointed father. I appreciate his tactics intellectually. Many detectives would go at me hard, but he instinctively knows that what disarms me, what I don't know how to parry, is kindness. We both know that isn't going to be the end of it, don't we? Now let's go back to the beginning.
That was the beginning.
Not this morning. I want to go back to the first time you saw a body mutilated like this. I read the trial transcripts, watched all the video I could get. I know what you saw that day in the garage of your house. How did that feel?
Cognitive technique. He's trying to lead me back to a traumatic moment, put me back in that feeling of helpless horror. I take a moment, then say, like my entire life collapsed under my feet. Like I'd been living in hell, and not even knowing it. I was horrified. I'd never seen anything like that. I'd never even imagined it.
And when you realized that your husband was guilty, not just of that murder, but of others.
I put an edge in my voice.
How do you think I felt? And still feel? No idea, Miss Proctor. Bad enough to change your name, I guess, or maybe that was just so you could get people to stop harassing you.
I glare at him, but of course he's right, even though he minimizes it. For most people who exist in the normal world, the regular world, the idea of taking some internet mob's threats seriously is a sign of weakness. Prester is probably no different. I'm suddenly very glad that Sam is with the kids. If the phone starts ringing, he can handle the torrent of abuse. He'll be shocked at the intensity and volume of it. Most men are. I feel weirdly empty and too tired to care. I think of all the effort, all the money, and I think maybe I should have just stayed put back in Kansas, let the assholes take their best shot. If it all ends the same way, why put all the time and energy into trying to build a new, safe life? Prester is asking me something, and I've missed it, and I have to ask him to repeat it. He looks patient. Good detectives always look patient, at least at first.
Walk me through your days the last week.
Starting when?
Let's start with last Sunday.
It's an arbitrary place to begin, but I comply. It isn't tough. My life isn't normally a whirlwind of activity. I assume that the second victim disappeared on or around Sunday, given the state of her body.
I give a thorough accounting, but as I'm moving forward, I realize that I have a decision to make. The flight I took to visit Melvin in El Dorado falls inside this timeline. Am I going to tell Prester I paid my serial killer ex a call? Am I going to lie about it and hope I don't get caught out? That's really not an option, I realize. He's a good detective. He'll check visitor logs in Kansas, and he'll realize I've been to see Mel. Worse, he'll see I visited him right before the body came up. No good choices. I get the sense that whatever unseen force is pushing me has designed this moment, too. I look down at my hands, then up, staring out the front window of the sedan. It's warm in here and smells of old, stale coffee. As interrogation rooms go, it could be worse. I turn and look at Prester and tell him about the visit to El Dorado, about the copies of letters he'll find in my house from Melvin Royal, about the torrent of abuse and threats that keep coming at me. I don't make it dramatic. I don't weep or shake or show him any sign of weakness. I don't think it will matter if I do. Prester nods as if he already knew all that. Maybe he did. Or maybe he's just a great poker player. Miss Proctor, I'm going to have to take you into the station now. You understand that? I nod. He takes handcuffs out from behind him. They're in a worn old case on the back of his belt, and I turn without complaint and let him lock them on. As he does, he tells me I'm under arrest for suspicion of murder. I can't say I'm surprised. I can't say I'm even angry. The questioning is a blur. It goes on for hours. I drink bad coffee, water, eat a cold sandwich of turkey and cheese sometime in there. I nearly fall asleep because I'm so tired, and finally the numbness is gone, and I can be afraid, so afraid it feels like a constant cold storm inside. I know that if the news hasn't gotten out yet, it will in a matter of hours, and in less than a day it'll be around the world. The 24-hour news cycle feeding an endless appetite for violence and spawning thousands of new, eager recruits to punish me. My children are exposed, fragile, and it's my fault. I stick to my story, which is all the truth at this point. I'm told there are witnesses to swear that I was seen in town the day the first girl disappeared. Turns out she was also eating at the bakery where Lanny and I stopped to gorge ourselves after her suspension from school. I barely remember her, the girl in the corner with the iPad and tattoo. I wasn't focused on anyone but my daughter and all my petty problems. It prickles needles all up and down my spine to think that no one saw that girl after the bakery, that someone abducted her out of that parking lot, maybe while we were still inside, maybe just after we'd gone. Whoever was doing this, I think, watched us the entire time. Even worse, they must have been following us, following me, waiting until there was proximity to a victim who matched the profile that they could safely grab. Even then, it was a huge risk, not something for amateurs, even in a small town, especially in a small town, people notice anything out of the ordinary, abducting a woman in broad daylight. Something slips across my mind, something important, but I'm too tired to make sense of it. Prester wants to start at the beginning again. I go through my life since fleeing Wichita. I describe in detail my movements, from the time the first girl disappeared to the time the second surfaced in the lake. I tell him everything I can remember of my conversation with my ex-husband. None of it helps him at all. But I'm trying, and I know he can tell. A knock comes at the door, and another detective offers another sandwich and a soda, and I accept. So does Prester. We eat together, and he tries casual chat. I'm not in the mood, and besides, I recognize it as technique, not interest. We finish our food in silence, and we're just getting back to the questions when the knock comes again. Prester sits back in his chair, frowning, as the other officer leans in. I don't know him. He's also African-American, but far younger than Prester. Barely old enough to be out of college, I think. He glances at me, then turns his attention to the detective. "Sorry, sir," he says. "There's been a development. You should probably hear this." Prester looks irritated, but he shoves back from the table and follows. Before the door is closed, I see someone being led down the hall past the door. It's only a glimpse, but I take in that it's a white man in handcuffs, and I have an instant impression of recognition well before I can think who it is. When I do, I sit back hard in my chair, clutching the half-empty can of Coke so hard it crackles with pressure. Why the hell is Sam Cade here in handcuffs? And where the hell are my kids? 9. The interrogation room door is locked, of course, and though I batter at it and yell, I get no response at all, not until my voice has grown hoarse and my knuckles red from knocking. It's Prester who finally unlocks the door and shoves himself in the way to keep me from charging out. I don't quite make contact with him. I back off a step, breathing hard, and say in the harsh, growling voice I've developed, "Where are my kids?" "They're fine," he tells me in that low, soothing tone as he closes the door behind him. "Come on now, Ms. Proctor, you sit down. Sit. You're tired, and I'll tell you everything you need to know." I find myself sinking into the chair again, wary and tense, hands fisted on my thighs. He stares at me for a second before he sits and leans forward on his elbows. "Now then, you must have seen Mr. Cade being brought in a while ago." I nod. My gaze is fixed on his. I wish desperately that I could read him. Did Sam do something to my kids? Prester's face goes a little slack and then tightens, and he shakes his head. "No, Gwen, not at all. They're just fine. Nothing's happened to them. I expect they're a little scared about what's going on and where they are right now." "Then why do you have Sam?" Prester stares at me for a long while this time, reading me. He has a file in his hand, I realize, not the same one he had before. This one has a new buff-colored exterior, hasn't even gotten a label on it yet. He puts it on the table, but doesn't open it. He says, "What exactly do you know about Sam Cade?" I want to scream at him to just tell me, but I know I have to play the game, so I control my voice and say, "I ran a background check on him, credit check, all that kind of stuff. I do it for anyone who comes around me or my kids. He was clean, a veteran who served in Afghanistan, just like he said." "That's all true," he tells me. He opens the folder and takes out a formal military photo, Sam Cade, a little younger, a little less ragged, in a sharply creased blue Air Force uniform. "Decorated helicopter pilot. 4 tours, Iraq and Afghanistan. Came home to find out his beloved sister was dead." He opens my folder now, takes out the picture of the nightmare, the dead woman dangling from her steel noose. Suddenly I am there again, standing in the sun on the ruined lawn, staring into the shattered sanctum of Mel's garage. I smell the stench of dead flesh, and it takes everything I have not to shut my eyes, hide myself from it. "This," Prester says, tapping the photo with one thick fingernail one time, "is his sister Callie. No surprise you missed his relationship to her. They got orphaned in a car wreck when he was 8 and she was 4. Went to separate foster homes. He kept his birth parents' name, but she didn't. She got a full adoption and grew up not even knowing him. They started corresponding when he was deployed. I guess he was really looking forward to reconnecting with her when he got home. And he comes back from serving his country to find this." My mouth has gone dry. I think about how close I came to discovering the connection. I think about the searches that turned up nothing. He must have gone to some lengths to keep his name off the web, or he hired someone to clean it off. Sam Cade has been stalking me. I have no question about it now. He moved in after I had, into that cabin, though he made a point of not encountering me until much later on. He made it seem natural. He worked his way in the door, into my life, into the lives of my kids, and I hadn't seen a thing. I wanted to throw up. Gwen Proctor wasn't a new person. She was just Gina Royal 2.0, ready to fall for anything sold to her by a man with a nice face and an easy smile. I'd left him with my kids. Jesus, God forgive me. I can't get my breath. I realize I'm sucking in air too fast, and I duck my head and try to control my breathing. I feel lightheaded, and I hear the scrape of the chair as Prester gets up and comes around to rest his hand gently on my back.
Easy, he tells me. Easy, slow down now. Deep breaths. In. Out. Good.
I pant the question out, ignoring his advice.
What did he do?
Anger is what I need. Anger steadies me, grounds me, gives me a purpose, and forces the panic right out. I straighten up, blinking away the spots, and he takes a step back. I wonder what he's just seen in my face.
Is it him?
Is Sam the one who killed those girls?
Because wouldn't that just be perfect?
Gina Royal falls for a serial killer twice. Can't say I don't have a type.
We're looking into that, Prester says. Point is, Mr. Cade is a person of interest, and we're questioning him. Sorry about springing it on you that fast, but I wanted to know.
You wanted to see if I already knew who he was, I snap back. Of course I fucking didn't know. I'd never have left my kids with him, would I? I can see him taking the idea out for a spin. No way I'd willingly allow a victim's relative into my life, into my house, if I had known better. Prester's trying to fit some scenario together where Sam Cade and I have done this together. But not only do the edges not fit, they're not even from the same damn puzzle. Either I killed these girls, or Sam Cade did, in some crazy attempt to implicate me and earn me the prison sentence he thought I'd cheated, or neither of us did it. But we didn't do it together, not by the facts he's got before him. Prester doesn't like this at all. I can see him working at it, and I don't blame him for looking like he needs a bottle of bourbon and a day off.
If Cade did this, I tell him, then you nail his ass to the wall. For God's sake, do it.
He sighs. He's in for another long day, and I can tell he knows it. He reads the file folder again, flipping pages, and I let him think about it. When he finally stands up, he gathers his files and pictures. I can see he's made a decision, and sure enough, he holds the door open for me and says,
"Your kids are down the hall to the right in the break room. Sam drove them here in your Jeep. Take 'em home. But don't leave town. If you do, I'll make it my personal mission to set the FBI on your trail, and I will ruin whatever life you've got left. Understand me?"
I nod. I don't thank him, because he's not really doing me any favors. He realizes that he's got precious little to hold me on, if anything, and a good defense attorney, like, say, one from Knoxville, would knock his case into the trash without even breaking a sweat, especially with Sam Cade right here hiding in plain sight. Christ, even I feel a little sorry for Prester in that moment. But not enough to hesitate. I'm out the door in a second, rushing past the small bullpen room of the Norton Police Department. I see Officer Graham filling in some paperwork, and he looks up as he sees me pass. I don't nod or smile, because I'm too fixed on the break room door. It's clear glass with mini blinds hanging at a cockeyed angle, and through the gap I see Lanny and Connor sitting together at a square white table, dispiritedly picking at a bag of popcorn sitting open between them. I take a breath, because seeing them alive and fine and unharmed feels so good. It physically hurts. I open the door and step in, and Lanny stands up so fast her chair skids backward across the tile and nearly tips over. She rushes to me and remembers that she's the oldest just in time to not throw herself into my arms. Connor blasts past her and flings himself at me instead, and I hug him fiercely and open one arm to her, and she grudgingly accepts. I feel the stabbing relief start to melt, replaced with something sweeter, warmer. Kinder.
They arrested you, Lanny says.
Her voice is muffled against me, but she pulls away to look directly at me on the last word.
Why did they do that?
They think I might be responsible for... I don't finish the thought, but she does.
For the murders, she says.
Sure, because of Dad. She says it like it's the most logical conclusion in the world.
Maybe it is. But you didn't do it.
She says it with casual conviction, and I feel a swell of love for her, for that unthinking trust. She's usually so suspicious of my motives that having her grant me this one thing means more than I can begin to comprehend. Connor pulls away then and says,
Mom, they came and got us. I said we shouldn't go, but Lanny said
we're not getting into a stupid fight with the cops, Lanny supplies, which we didn't. Besides, they didn't come for us, exactly. They just couldn't leave us there alone. I made them bring the jeep, so we'd have a way home.
She hesitates for a moment and tries to make the next question look casual.
So did they tell you why they want to talk to Sam? Was it something you told them?
I don't want to open up the subject of what their father did, how many people he destroyed, how many families he shattered, including his own. But at the same time, I know I have to explain. They're not little children now, and things, I know this instinctively, are about to get a whole lot worse for all of us. But I'm reluctant to destroy Sam Cade in their eyes. They like him, and as far as I could tell, he liked them, too. But then again, I thought he liked me. Maybe he is part of the murder plot that has cost those two girls their lives. I still can't see Sam killing them, even now, and yet I can easily understand how grief and rage and pain pushes someone past limits they never think they'd cross. I destroyed the old Gina Royal and rebuilt myself from her ashes. He's focused on his anger outward at me, at his imaginary enemy. Maybe the young women were, to him, collateral damage, cold military math to reach an objective. I can almost believe that.
Mom?
I blink. Connor's looking at me with real worry, and I wonder how long I've wandered off in my thoughts. I'm so tired. Despite the sandwich, I find I'm starving, and I need to pee so badly I wonder if my bladder will burst before I can make it to the bathroom. Funny. All these were unimportant details until I knew the kids were safe.
We'll talk on the way home, I tell him. Quick pit stop and then we'll go, okay?
He nods a little doubtfully. He's worried about Sam, I think, and I hate to break his heart again. But this one isn't my fault. I make it to the toilet in time and shiver and cry silently as I sit there. By the time I've washed my face and hands and taken some deep breaths, the face staring back at me from the mirror almost looks normal. Almost. I realize that I need to get a haircut and renew my hair color. A few gray hairs are starting to make an unwelcome appearance. Funny. I always thought I'd die before I got old. That's a whisper from the old Gina, who'd seen the day of the event as the end of her entire life. I hate the old Gina, who'd somehow naively believed in the power of true love and the smug certainty that she was a good woman and her husband was a good man, and that it was something she deserved without putting out any effort at all. I hate her even more now that I realize I'm still, after all this, very much like her. The drive home starts in silence, but I can tell it's weighted. The kids want to know. I want to tell them. I just don't quite know how to find the words, so I reach out and fiddle with the Jeep's radio knobs, jumping from new country to southern fried rock to old country to what sounds like tinny folk music, until Lanny reaches forward and switches it off with a decisive punch of her finger.
Enough, she says. Come on, spill. What's the deal with Sam?
Dear God, I don't want to start this. But I swallow that impulse of cowardice and say, Sam's sister. It turns out that Sam isn't who he said he was. Well, he is, but he didn't tell us the whole truth.
You're not making any sense, Connor tells me.
He's probably right.
Wait, is Sam's sister in the lake? Did he kill his sister?
Hey, Lanny says sharply, let's not jump right to killing sisters, okay? Sam didn't kill anybody. I wonder why I didn't see it before, because right now, with a single glance over at her face, I can see that she's irate, agitated, and truly defensive. She'd had an insta-crush on Officer Graham, but this is different. This I read not as a crush, but as a need. Sam, who's been quietly in her life, being strong and kind and steady. He's the next best thing she has to a father.
No, I tell her. And reach out to squeeze her hand just for a second. I feel her tense up as I do.
Of course he didn't. Connor, they took him to the police station because they found out he has a connection to us. From before. Lanny draws away to press against the vehicle's door. I see Connor sit back, too.
Before?
My son asks quietly. His voice trembles slightly.
You mean, like, when we used to be other people?
Yes. I'm guiltily relieved I don't have to lead them to it. When we lived in Kansas. His sister. His sister was one of the people your father killed. I don't tell them his sister was the last one. Somehow that makes it even worse.
Oh,
Lanny says in a small voice. It sounds empty.
So, he followed us here, didn't he? He was never really our friend. He wanted to watch us, hurt us because he was angry about what Daddy did.
Oh, God, she called him Daddy. It cuts deep and leaves me feeling frantic with anguish.
Honey, she's right,
Connor says from the back. When I glance in the rearview mirror, I see him staring out the window, and in that moment he looks quite chillingly like his father. So much so that I stare for too long and have to correct a little sharply back into my lane as we drive up the winding road to the lake.
He wasn't our friend. We don't have any friends. It was stupid to think we did.
Hey, that's not true, Lenny says. You've got the Geek Squad playing nerd games with you. And what about Kyle and Lee, those Graham kids? They're always asking you to do things.
I said I don't have any friends. Just people I play games with is all, Connor says.
There's an edge to his voice I haven't heard before, and I don't like it. At all. I don't like the Graham kids, either. I just pretend I do so they don't beat me up again. From the look on my daughter's face, she didn't know that until this moment either. I think that Connor must have confided in Sam, and that with Sam's betrayal, Connor has no more use for his secret. I feel frozen. I remember the stiff way Connor held himself when he was around the Graham boys. I remember his warning, that first time, about how he hadn't lost his phone, that one of them must have taken it. I hate myself for not questioning that. In the rush of events, in my worry about what Mel was doing and the murder, I'd forgotten. I'd let my son down. When Sam found him with the bloody nose, the bruises, that was the work of the Graham brothers. I grit my teeth and don't say anything for the rest of the drive. Lanny and Connor don't seem to want to talk either. I pause at the entrance to the driveway, put the Jeep in park, and turn to face them. I can't fix what's gone wrong for us. It's just happened. I don't know whose fault it is, and I don't really care anymore. But I promise you one thing. I'm going to take care of you. Both of you. And if anybody tries to hurt you, they're going to have to come through me first. Understand? They do, but I can see it doesn't soothe something in them that's still wired tense. Lanny says, You're not always here, Mom. I know you want to be, but sometimes we have to look out for each other. And it'd be better if you'd let me have the code to the...
Lanny, no.
But... I know what she wants. Access to the gun safe. And I'm not willing to do it. I never wanted this. I never wanted to raise my kids to have to be gunslingers, warriors, child soldiers. As long as I have the power to protect them, I won't allow it. I put the Jeep in gear in the fraught silence and crunch up the gravel road to our house. As the headlights hit it, I see blood. That's all I see in the first rush of recognition, a vivid red splash over the garage door, splatters and whirls and drips. I brake hard, throwing us all against restraints. The halogens pick it out, and I realize the red probably isn't blood at all. It's too red, too thick. It's still wet and glimmering in the lights, though, and as I watch, I see one of the drips is still lengthening its descent. It hasn't been long since this happened.
Mom,
Connor whispers. I don't look at him. I'm staring now at the words scrawled on our windows, across the brick, on the front door of our house. Murderer. Bitch. Scum. Killer. Whore. Fuck you. Die.
Mom?
Connor's hand grips my shoulder, and I hear the panic in my son's voice, the very real fear. I jam the Jeep in reverse and spray gravel, rocketing down the driveway toward the road. I have to brake suddenly, because there are vehicles in the way. Two of them. a mint-condition dust-free Mercedes SUV, and a dirty jacked-up truck that might be red under the mud coating. They've blocked us in. The Johansons, the nice, quiet couple from up the hill, the ones I introduced myself to when I moved in, they're in their SUV, not looking at me, staring at the road as if blocking my fucking driveway is an accident, as if they're not involved. The asshole in the muddy red truck and his friends have no such scruples. They're happy to be noticed. There are three of them getting out of the extended cab, and another three sloppily crawling out of the bed of the truck, drunk from the lack of coordination, and pretty thrilled about it, too. I recognize one of them. He's the jackass from the range, Carl Goetz, the one Javier blackballed for bad behavior. They start walking toward us, and I realize with a chill that I have my kids with me and I am unarmed, and Jesus, the cops haven't even bothered to leave a cruiser in the neighborhood to watch out for harassment. So much for Prester's good intentions, if he ever had any. Less than a day out from being hauled in and we're already in fear of our lives. This is why I drive the Jeep. I slam it into low gear, go uphill a bit, and then take it on a bouncing course down the steep slope, over wild grassland littered with buried jutting stones. I steer around the worst of it, but I have to speed up as I realize that the truck's driver and crew are piling back in. He's got four-wheel drive, too. He'll be coming after us, fast as he can. I need to put distance between us. I need my gun, I think desperately. I don't have a weapon in the safe at the back right now. I'd taken it out in preparation for trading the Jeep to Javier. Doesn't matter, I tell myself. Depending on anything or anyone else is bad. I have to rely on myself, first, last, and always. That's the lesson Mal taught me. First, I have to get us to safety. Second, regroup. Third, get my kids away from this place, however that has to happen. I almost make it to the safety of the road. It happens like this. I have to twist the wheel sharply to avoid a jutting boulder that's hidden by a clump of thick weeds, and in doing so, I run the right wheel into a wide, unseen gully. The whole Jeep tips, and for a heart-stopping moment, I think about the high incidence of rollover crashes, and then we bounce up and back out even before Lanny's sudden yelp hits my ears, and I think, we're okay. We're not okay. The left wheel hits and glances off a half-buried rock, and we veer over it. I hear the metallic crunch of collision, and the whole steering assembly shudders out of my hands, jumping wildly. I grab hold again, my heart thudding in a steady staccato race, and I realize that the axle's broken. I've lost control of the front wheels and the steering. I can't go around the next rock, which is big enough to smash us right in the center of the Jeep's hood and send us all flying forward into the restraints, hard enough to leave bruises. And I know the airbags deploy because I feel the puff of it against my face, the impact, the burning smell of the propellant. My face hurts and feels hot from the rush of blood and friction. I'm more aware of surprise than pain, but my first instinct is not for myself. I twist in my seat to look frantically at Lanny, at Connor. They both seem dazed but okay. Lanny makes a little whimpering sound and probes at her nose. It's bleeding. I realize I'm bleating questions at them. Are you all right? Are you okay? But I'm not even listening for answers. I'm grabbing up handfuls of tissues to press to the flow of blood from her nose, even as I'm looking anxiously at Connor. He seems okay, better than Lanny, though he has a red mark on his forehead. The flaccid white silk of a deflated airbag is draped over his shoulder. Side curtain airbags, I remember. Lanny's deployed too, which is why her nose is bleeding. Mine might be too. I don't care. I compose myself enough to remember that we didn't just accidentally get into a car wreck, that there's a truck full of drunken men rambling over this same hillside, hunting us. I've screwed up. I've put my children in mortal danger. And I have to fix it. I scramble out of the Jeep and almost fall. I catch myself on the door and realize I'm trailing fat drops of blood in a ragged line down the front of my white shirt. Doesn't matter. I shake my head, sending red drops flying, and fumble my way to the back of the Jeep. I do have two things, a tire iron and an emergency flashlight that strobes disorienting white and red with a flick of a switch. It even has a built-in piercing alert signal. The batteries are fresh because I changed them out just last week. I grab it and the heavy iron curve of the toolbar, and before I slam the driver's side door again, I find my cell phone and pitch it to Connor, who seems more together. Call 911, I tell him. Tell them we're being attacked. Lock these doors. Mom, don't stay out there, he says, and I worry that he won't lock the doors after all, that he'll hesitate and get dragged out. So I open the door and trigger the locks, which thunk down solidly. Then I roll up the windows to leave him, Lanny, and the keys inside. I turn with the tire iron in my right hand, the multi-purpose flash in my left, to wait for the pickup truck to get closer. It doesn't make it. Halfway down the hill, they hit something, skid sideways, and I watch as the men in the back throw themselves out, yelling as the truck overbalances on the downhill side. One screams in a way that makes me think he's broken something, or bent it pretty badly. But the other two bounce up the boneless way drunks have. The truck rolls over in a long screech of metal and cymbal crash of shattering glass, but it doesn't keep going down the hill. It stops on its side, tires spinning, engine still roaring like the driver hasn't the good sense to take his foot off the gas. The three inside start yelling for help, and the two still upright from the truck bed scramble to help them. They nearly overbalance the whole thing and send it tumbling farther downhill. It's a bit of a comedy. I see the Johansson's SUV suddenly start up and peel out hastily on the road, as if they just remembered they are late to their own party. I'm assuming they faint at the sight of blood, even mine. I know they won't be calling the police, but it hardly matters. Connor's already done it. All I need to do, I tell myself, is to keep anyone hostile occupied until the lights and sirens show up. I haven't done anything wrong. Not yet, anyway. One of the drunk guys peels off and heads my direction, and I find myself tremendously not surprised that it's the one from the range, Carl, the one who insulted Javi. He's yelling something at me, but I'm not really listening. I'm just trying to see if he has a gun. If he does, I'm sunk. Not only can he kill me from where he stands, but he can claim I attacked him with my handy tire iron, and it was self-defense. I know Norton well enough to guess how that will go. They'll hardly pause for 5 minutes before they acquit the bastard, even if my kids give testimony. I was in fear for my life, he'll say, the standard defense of murderous cowards. Problem is, it's also the defense for legitimately frightened people, like me. A relief. He doesn't seem to have a gun, at least not that I can see, and he's hardly the type to be coy about it. He'd be waving it around if he had it, which makes my tire iron into a real threat. He pauses, and I realize that Connor is hammering at the window of the Jeep, trying to make me look at him. I risk a glance. His face looks desperately pale. I hear him yell, "I called the cops, Mom! They're coming!" "I know you did, sweetie." I give him a smile, a real smile, because this might be the last time I get to do that. Then I turn on the drunk guy, whose other friend is heading toward us now, and I say, "Back the fuck off!" They both laugh. The one who's just arrived is a little broader and a little taller, but he's also even more drunk and has to hang on to the first guy as rocks turn under his feet. Keystone cops, but deadly serious about the violence they'd like to do.
"You fucked up our truck," he says. "Gonna have to pay for that, you murdering bitch."
Back at the overturned truck, the passenger side door is creaking up like a hatch in a tank, but unlike a tank, and I could have told these idiots this, car doors aren't designed to flip back and lie flat. The attempt to throw the door up and out of the way causes it to hit the hinge point and rebound at the man pushing it with vicious speed. He yelps and lets go of the sides of the truck just before his fingers are crushed. It'd be funny if I weren't scared shitless and responsible for two innocent children, whereas these jackasses aren't even responsible for their own selves. When the two facing me decide to rush me, I flip the stun function switch on the flashlight and keep it pointed away from me as I activate it. It's still like a brick to the face, the strobing, asymmetric, incredibly bright lights, and the ear-shattering shriek are bad enough behind the thing, much less ahead of it. It knocks Carl and his friend flat on their asses, mouths open in frantic yells I can't hear over the din. I feel a bitter, fantastic rush of adrenaline that makes me want to smash the hell out of them with the tire iron and make sure, absolutely sure, that these assholes never threaten my children again. But I don't. I'm on the thin, shivering edge of it, but what stops me is the idea that I'll just prove Prester right, prove myself a murderer, local blood on my hands. As quickly as they'd acquit someone else for shooting me, they'd strap me down for the needle if I hit these guys when they're down. It's really all that keeps me standing there, holding the strobe and siren on them instead of finishing this for good. Even though I'm blinded by the strobes, I know the police are coming when Connor rolls the window down next to me and grabs my arm.